And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm pleased to welcome Lauren Long back to the program today. Lauren is a writer and illustrator of children's books. He may be best known for his Otis the Tractor series, but he has also illustrated classic stories like The Little Engine That Could, as well as books written by Frank McCourt and Barack Obama. He has had two books released in 2018, Love, which was written by Matt de la Peña, and There's a Hole in a Log on the Bottom of the Lake, which is published by Philomel. And we begin our conversation with Lauren and I talking about his fellow and legendary colleague in the world of children's books, Marla Frazee. Is it a fairly close circle, the illustrators and writers of children's books?
It can be, yeah. Marla and I judged a show, an illustration show, years ago for the SCBWI, the Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. I just remember thinking, this person may have forgotten more about the art of making a picture book than I'll ever know. I mean, I just really respected her thinking and her methodology of making a book, and judging a show together was a different kind of exposed a different aspect of someone, as opposed to just saying, oh, I like her, or I like this book, or I like. We had to describe why we like it, and kind of be willing to advocate for the books we were choosing. And I just thought she was very intellectually on target, you know, and I just admired that.
Did it change the way you approached your books after working with her?
A little bit, yeah. It really did. You know, back then I had just started, so I was, you know, you're just as a young illustrator or as a newer illustrator to the field, I was just trying to make paintings and tell a story. You know, I felt like I had a storytelling ability, but I think talking to Marla really was when I began to start thinking about, okay, if this is what my art is for, how can it be the most effective? As opposed to showing off, how can we tell stories with the children in mind that are going to be holding the books? I know Marla would probably recall us judging the show, but I'm not sure she'd recall all of our discussions and whatnot, but she's always been an influence, not an influence, but an impactful person in my children's book career.
Did you ever feel a split of between trying to impress an acquisitions editor versus, you know, entertaining the children?
Yeah, I'm not sure that part of it splits apart. I think it was more me splitting apart with trying to show off as a painter whatever my chops were in the beginning, and actually thinking about, instead of trying to impress, just prove that I could paint or whatever, trying to remember the audience. You know, am I painting for adults and for art, or am I trying to get to the bottom of the story and pace it out and make sure? Sometimes you have to check your ego at the door. I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, well, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, for the bottom line. And The Little Engine That Could was a turning point for me too. I'd painted warm and peel, but not cute, you know, and adorable, you know, like a little blue engine with eyeballs.
Beyond eyeballs, how do you make something cute?
Oh man, it's a whole thing. Like Otis the Tractor, if you make his front of his face, if you make it longer, he goes from being cute and appealing and approachably adorable to almost a little goofy or dopey, for lack of a better description. If you make his eyes too close, he could be almost a little sinister. They have to be about the right distance apart to get that wide-eyed, innocent feel, you know. I don't know if it's a little hard to describe.
Well, I would guess it would have to be kind of similar proportions to that what babies have or younger animals.
Right.
Because I guess that's what we interpret as cute, are juvenile,
yeah,
beings.
Absolutely.
We're taping, but
oh, know, we are. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Good.
Because this is good stuff we got going.
Yeah,
here.
This is perfect. The Cincinnati Zoo, one of their biggest deals, one of their biggest things is conservation and education. The Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden in Cincinnati, and they asked me to do a new Zoo Babies poster. And it's a really big 37-inch by 40-something poster of all of their babies. One of their most famous recent babies was Fiona the hippopotamus. I actually did the poster before that, but something you just said about the eyes of a child being wide and open and larger, it's the same thing with animals. So when I was doing that poster, my biggest thing was big, wide eyes, raised eyebrows. You know, whether you're doing a polar bear or a baby or a Otis the tractor, wide eyes, high eyebrows, and a certain sweetness that you try and get through the eyes of innocence, and but also just this appeal. Like, I wanted all those animals in that poster. There's like, 15 or 12, you know, baby animals, a giraffe, an elephant, a rhinoceros, and I wanted them all to be looking out as if to say, I'm here at the zoo, come and see me, you know? And on Otis the tractor, I have these little chrome metal ornamental things on the top of his head that serve as eyebrows. And I was able to use those a lot when I was drawing emotion into the tractor. You know, if he was determined, they would be down and lower like eyebrows. If he was afraid, you know, you could get so much human emotion, and children totally get it. And the best thing is they feel it. They don't just see it, they feel it.
Which of the animals were the most challenging to get that feeling from?
The most challenging were, like, we had a baby owl, and I had to kind of use a little artistic license there because a baby owl really doesn't look like an owl in terms of its feathers and fuzz. So I kind of had to make it look a little bit more like a baby face, but some owl characteristics in it. The giraffe was a little hard because a baby giraffe, you know, is pretty tall to begin with, you know, compared to, so I had to make the giraffe fit with all the other animals.
But they have fairly expressive faces, it seems.
They do. They have very big eyes, so that one wasn't too hard. The zebra wasn't terribly easy either because it's like a horse, so the eyes are sort of on the side, and all the animals are looking directly at you.
And I'm sure with the striping, that kind of interferes with the eyebrow placement and everything.
Mm-hmm. I kind of had to simplify that. I think one of the things I would say to artists when they're trying to make things simple or appealing in a youthful way is that word simplify, trying to draw everything. And that almost goes back to me having to, when I dedicated my art specifically for children's literature, that's the time when I really started to simplify. In other words, you can say a lot by the feel of a figure and the posture of the figure without drawing every fold in the clothing and every wrinkle on a face. And I just started to really try and simplify. And I feel like as an artist, it served me in my particular style because I tend to really go overboard with the details in art. Like, typically when I'm making a book, an art director, I'm sort of proud of this, but an art director has to tell me, okay, you can stop, as opposed to keep working. You need to keep working. And I don't know if that's an underdog mentality in my particular, you know, life, or if it's just, it could be just a certain amount of me trying to improve myself and continue to do the best work I can.
It must have been a challenge for, there's a hole in the log on the bottom of the lake, because with an Otis book or Love that you did with Matt De La Pena earlier this year, you know, you have that sense of depth in the backgrounds. You can really kind of geek out and put some intricate designs in the background, but you just have murky water as the backdrop on these scenes.
And that was something that evolved, actually, because in the beginning I did have texture and a little more depth. And then I realized that the typography of the book, which is essential because the book is a repetitive growing thing. And the next thing you know, the both spreads are pretty much filled with text. So some of the depth and texture I was putting in some of the early pictures worked fine with one or two lines, but they didn't work with the other.
Started to fight for attention.
It started to fight for attention, and the art director and I realized early on, we have to go with something pretty flat. In this book, it's a set that is the same and changes only because of the things that are adding and adding and adding and adding and adding and adding and subtracted. But we realized this book isn't about using cinematography necessarily and different angles to tell the story, it's going to be pretty much the repetition of text. And that's one of the reasons I added like the little turtle and snail. You know, when you're singing it, they're not even mentioned. But if you are a child on a lap with just your mom or dad or someone who loves you, and they're singing this silly song / reading it, then the child can sit there and watch what the turtle and snail are doing. I could tell you why I wanted to do this book and why I wanted to do it now.
Well, no, we don't want to hear that at all.
I just asked myself a question.
By all means, go ahead. Yeah.
But it goes back to the series of books that led up to this. And even back to, like I mentioned, The Little Engine That Could and Otis the Tractor and doing the President Obama book of The Icing, A Letter to My Daughters, and then writing one of my own stories, Little Tree. Those books all had weight, you know, a certain amount of weight. Little Tree, I wrote since I've seen you, Stephen, I wrote it and illustrated it when my oldest son was approaching college age. He was in his high school years toward the end, and the almost time clock was ticking as I watched him go from being just a young teenager to preparing applications for college. And it started really affecting me a little bit inside in terms of just internalizing the anxiety of the fact that he was going to leave. And I talked with my wife about it, and she had a certain piece about it, interestingly, that I didn't have. And it wasn't anything major, but it just was really eating at me, and I couldn't change it. And it started just affecting me, the fear of letting go, the fear of not him. He was fine. He was excited. And I knew that. And intellectually, I could say, this is great for him. But inside, I was like, what does it do for me? You know, he's going to move out of my house. I haven't done all my job like a dad. I can't stop this.
And yeah, but you had done your job so well, he was able to do that, to leave.
I suppose. But in my head, I'm like, I haven't taught him everything. Have I taught him? Have I done everything? You know, I've been so busy my whole life, his whole life. And you just have to kind of trust that you did your best and that it's not over. The fear of change, I had this moment where I just thought, it's like I'm a little tree that's afraid to let go of its leaves. What would happen if you didn't let go of your leaves? Well, you'd have your leaves. They'd turn gray and brown, and then all the other leaves turn beautiful colors, and they drop. Yours change. But what happens in that fall when that young tree doesn't? So I just started asking myself questions like that, and then I thought, well, the next spring, all the other trees would be a little larger, and they'd have these beautiful green leaves, and you'd have your gray, you know, leaves. And not until you let go. You stunt your own growth, essentially. And it made me feel good, because the moment when the little tree decides to let his leaves go, and all the other trees are so large and tall that he can't hear the morning dove sing, and he can't see the sun because of their canopy of leaves, because they're so big, when he finally decides to let his leaves go, he feels the harsh cold of winter. And that line that I kind of arrived at when I was writing it gave me such peace, because that's the truth. Seeing my son go to college or any big new change does feel like the harsh cold of winter. But then you let it go and something begins to happen. And in this case, the little tree grew and grew and grew. These books, along with Matt DeLaPena's Love, that have such big life themes.
It's such a wide range of emotion. They've got almost everything in them.
Yeah, exactly. Those kinds of big, heavy books, which are so important, I believe. The book Matt DeLaPena wrote, Love, that I had the honor to illustrate, says so much about the world, especially the world we're living in now, just about how you, in the best scenario, and hopefully the most common scenario, when you're born, you receive love. It comes to you. You learn that it's not always perfect. You learn that people aren't always perfect in this book. What I loved about Matt's text is it went into a couple of, you know, truthful, maybe a little heavier areas than I'd ever illustrated. And it gave me, the illustrator, a lot of room to tell my own story and bring my own, you know, sensibilities to it. Like he said, the sky above your trailer turns the color of love so poetically. And I remember reading that thinking, did he just say trailer? This is a picture book. And I'm like, I don't think I've seen a trailer. And we've heard from so many people that were that child that grew up in a trailer and they never saw themselves in a book. And there's a moment where, and summers end, and so do friends and people. And that was a moment where I was able to kind of draw from not only my own family, but so many children around the world who may have had a loving family, but that didn't last or that broke away. If we have 50% divorce rate in our country, then how many children are the metaphorical child under the piano, like I have in my illustration, where the mother's on the left crying and the father's maybe stumbling out of the room on the right. So I have that, thankfully not in my own marriage, but in my brother's marriage, in my cousin's marriage, in my uncle's. And sometimes there's a problem with addiction, which I also suggested in the illustration. And that was something that I was fortunate enough to be able to talk over with the author. So I'd met Matt and we'd become friends. I asked him and we discussed when I first took the project from him through the agent. We met at a conference. And I remember we were in a van getting shuttled from an event to another event. And I said, man, I'm so excited about the project. He said, me too. You know, we just shook hands the first time meeting. And I said, we usually don't work this way, or I don't, but I'd love to talk about this with you because you went to some different places in this. And I'm thrilled to be the illustrator that gets to portray those. But it was a hard illustration assignment because his text doesn't define, you know, which can be the most awesome thing for an illustrator. His text, it wasn't literal.
But you really have to lock into his emotional valence.
Exactly. And it really helped me to learn about Matt's childhood and how it contrasted my own. It helped me to learn Matt's personality and his belief system and his character so that I could bring my own senses to that to see where he was coming from. And it was just a really great collaboration, probably the first time I'd ever really collaborated with an author that way. And I think it strengthened the final product. It empowered me so that I could paint a picture of a little child curled up under a piano while his parents are arguing. It empowered me to know that Matt was behind me on that, you know, because that was a bit of a risk, you know. And I think it was good because we've heard from so many people who were the child under the piano. If you have that many children from broken families, you know, first of all, I like to point out in that picture, there's still a tremendous amount of love. The love of the parents, you know, maybe the love for the parents of each other. We don't know if they're going to get divorced. We don't know what the problem is, but there's still a tremendous amount of love in that image. And if you're a child and you're in first grade or fifth grade going through that at home, you may not realize that five other kids in your class are going through similar situations. So when you see it in a book, all of a sudden you have this instant feeling of, I'm not alone. If you're a child from a perfectly stable family, then what better way to learn about empathy, to know that not everybody in your class is coming from the same starting point when it comes to their family life. So to me, Matt's text for love is just so important because there's a lot of empathy that's built on those pages through words and pictures that is evident on those pages to build from. And so, meaningful project.
So in creating those paintings and, yeah, and illustrations for the book, that you've gone through this verbal process with Matt in this case,
right,
on,
mm-hmm,
how is that different from then just funneling creativity from your brain to your fingers when you're,
yeah,
creating for stuff for your own books that you've written yourself?
I think what the discussions were great. And then we'd meet up a couple times when we were traveling in an NCTE and in a conference in Atlanta. And we sat down two or three times to go over thoughts and just, again, get to know each other. What were you thinking when you wrote this? And then I went home and, you know, buried myself in my studio and didn't talk to Matt for weeks and months. And then I would emerge with sketches. And then I started working more with the editor and the art director. What I didn't know is that I think they were sending him some of my stuff too. So then it went through the normal channels of editor, art director, Lauren, and then the editor working with Matt. Yeah, so then it just became normal. Like, this is me and my work when as an illustrator for picture books, when I'm not writing my own book, I feel like I have to love the text enough to own it, you know, because I do believe, and I think most people in our industry believe that a book is equally owned by the author and the illustrator. The story may have started with the author, but when an illustrator takes it on and spends all that time with it, it becomes their own just as much as the author. So at that point, I mean, even when I was illustrating Barack Obama's text, even somebody that famous and the president of the United States, I had to find this certain John Wayne arrogance that, hey, I wasn't in the room when President Obama wrote his material, and he's not in my studio right now when I'm making these paintings. These are my own, you know? And it takes a long time to get that confidence. But if you can't find that, you'll drive yourself crazy and you may not do your best work. So some of the high profile books that I've been fortunate enough to do, like even The Little Engine That Could, I kind of knew that a lot of people would see that because it's a famous classic picture book. I had to have that. I had to have that. Okay, Waddy Piper, the author of this book, which is, by the way, sort of controversial. Was there ever really a Waddy Piper? But whoever that is, isn't here. And they wrote that in the early 20s. It was published in 1930. And they're not here. And the artist for that original book isn't here. And the artist for the 1954 version that we grew up with isn't here. I had to own it, you know? It had to become mine.
In Love, there was a scene on a train platform, and it's raining. And, I mean, you really nailed the sense of the puddles and the rain dropping off the umbrellas. So how do you get a sense of wetness in the new book? How do you portray the underwater and make it feel like you're underwater?
Some of those visual effects from some of my normal characteristics aren't necessarily evident in There's a Hole in the Log on the Bottom of the Lake. So you can do that with highlights and eyeballs and some just murky, you know, a few bubbles here and there. But I really kind of liked the idea that this is just this dark, murky green. And the words are telling you this is underwater, you know, and this is all the way at the bottom. It's kind of, in a way, a little bit of a realistically cartooned version of the objects and what's happening in the book.
You had mentioned about this wide range of emotions that have been in your previous works.
Yeah.
Now, this book is just more about fun, fun, fun.
Right, right. So I really did feel like that. I love the broad spectrum of books being published in children's literature today. The wide range of techniques. People are doing amazing stuff digitally, creating their art. I don't work that way at this point in time. I might eventually. But I love the humor that a lot of people are bringing to picture books. I mean, it's always been around, but I love the way with a children's picture book, you can educate, you can bring about feelings and emotion and empathy, you can teach. But I also think that a lot of these books I've done, like Little Tree, about the message of letting go, and even some of the messages imparted in Otis, who's this noble character, but it has certain earnest quality to it. And what we did with Love and what the president did with Of the Icing. I love all that, but I also like humor, you know? I was talking to my agent over the past few years. Nobody thinks of me for a funny book. I'm like, I'm funny, you know? You know? I mean, that's always arguable, but yeah.
If you have to say it out loud, maybe not so much.
It's probably not, yeah. I always think of the Good Morning Vietnam movie where the guy wants to replace Robin Williams. He's trying so hard to convince everybody how funny he is, and then he's not funny. But nobody thinks of me for that because I haven't shown it in my books.
I think there's some general humor in the Otis books.
Yeah, I think there is. Thank you, Stephen. But I kind of felt like, hey, I should lighten up a little. And my father-in-law, seeing There's a Hole in the Log on the Bottom of the Lake, to sort of to the tune of There's a Hole at the Bottom of the Sea, which is a folk song that many people have heard. Not as many people have heard about it being at the bottom of the lake. There was a radio show called the Dr. Demento Show. Mm-hmm. Did you hear
that?
Yeah. When was that out?
I listened to it in the early 80s now. I think he's got a subscription plan now.
Okay, good. Dr. Demento Show. And I think that's, in my research, I found a performance of There's a Hole in the Log on the Bottom of the Lake. It was quite different. but it had that same repetitive buildup and speedy and kind of humorous singing. And of course, they were professional, did a bang-up job on it. But that was about the only thing. My father-in-law sang it to my wife and her siblings all growing up. They couldn't get enough of it. And it's just this silly song about a hole or a log on the bottom of the lake and a hole in a repetition. I heard Grandpa, my father-in-law, sing it to my two boys as they grew up. And the same thing, they couldn't get enough of it. Grandpa, sing it again, you know. And he did it at bedtime, anytime, you know, we were together with them. He did it when he got in the car. It was a sweet thing, you know, listening to this man who's my wife's father singing something to my sons that he sang to his own daughter. And he got similar reactions. And they loved it when he sped up and tongue-tied himself. The book, There's a Hole in a Log in the Bottom of the Lake, it has no more value other than to make kids giggle, hopefully. And a bit of a challenge from me, we put the simple music in the back to get near, if you're musically inclined, grab your piano, your guitar, your ukulele, and learn a few chords and sing that to your kids. Maybe you're a bookseller, maybe you're a librarian or a teacher. Sing that to your kids and watch them laugh at you. And know that 50 years later, they'll remember that you did that. To me, what better activity could you do, even if it's the only song you could perform? I took it up, and it's been a blast. You know, I go into schools randomly to share my books, and there's nothing more sweet than me being able to read Otis the Tractor and talk about the themes in my books and share the behind the scenes and talk to kids about what is a book before it's a book that you can get in the library or a bookstore. It's an idea. And I start with a blank sheet of paper, and it's scary. And then you just start drawing or you start writing. Just like I had Virgil, my father-in-law, write down the words. That was the start. Before it was that, it was just this idea in my head that I shared with my editor. And we decided that might be a good thing to pursue. And then I had Virgil write the words down. He even circled the repetitive words, and he never really had an ending. He just stopped. So I created a little bit of a surprise ending, and I also added the call out and response, because I felt like that would be fun for kids to do with their teacher or with whomever. There's a hole, there's a hole, there's a hole, hole, hole. So.
Now there is a surprise fate for a frog. In the course of the story, how do kids, I don't want to spoil it, but how do kids react to that surprise?
I'm glad I've been able to answer that after spending the better part of a week touring for the book, because I've been so tickled that they all gasp and they think it's funny. It's more cartoony at the very end because, and not to spoil it, but you'll see the shape of the big old fish. It's a big pike. My original fish that came in was a rainbow trout. And one of my friends who's an avid fisherman said, I don't know.
It'd be an awfully big trout to eat.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No. But he said, pike have really gnarly teeth. And then I did a little research, and they actually eat a lot of things along the bottom of the lake. They eat frogs, and fishermen have caught big old pikes and cut them open to find cans and bottles and 2x4s.
Well, and they have that nice, long, slender shape that would deform nicely for the joke.
Exactly, yeah. Most of it is humor, yeah. I haven't heard anyone that's reacted any other way.
Well, can you give us a couple of verses? You got your uke there in hand?
I do. I can. Yeah, my challenge, Stephen, is for anybody who's a musician will kill this. Anybody who's not can learn it. It's easy. The music's in the back. There's a log on the bottom of the lake. There's a log on the bottom of the lake. There's a log?
There's a log.
Good job, Stephen. There's a log. There's a log, log, log. There's a log on the bottom of the lake. Then it just continues. There's a hole in the log on the bottom of the lake. There's a hole in the log on the bottom of the lake. There's a hole?
There's a hole?
There's a hole. There's a hole, hole, hole in the log, log, log. There's a hole in hole in the log on the bottom of the lake. There's a frog.
There's a frog.
There's a frog. There's a frog, frog, frog in the hole, hole, hole in the log, log, log. There's a frog in the hole in the log on the bottom of the lake. Should I keep going or?
I think that's good. Yeah. We don't want to give the whole cow away.
Right, right, exactly. And you can play around with that or whatever, you know. Let me do one verse toward the end that gets really fast.
Okay.
We'll speed it up here. There's a gnat on the fly, on the hare, on the frog, in the hole, in the log, on the bottom of the lake. There's a gnat on the fly, on the hare, on the frog, in the hole, in the log, on the bottom of the lake. There's a gnat.
There's a gnat.
There's a gnat. There's a gnat, gnat, gnat on the fly, 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 on the hare, 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 on the frog, 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 in the hole, 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 in the log, log, log. There's a gnat on the fly, on the hare, on the frog, in the hole, in the log, on the bottom of the lake. I kind of messed that up.
So you hadn't played the ukulele before you started this project, had you?
No, I hadn't. I hadn't. And the funny thing is I kind of played around with the folks at Penguin, the editor and publisher and designer, art director, and I was just kind of goofing around saying, oh man, you know, I'm going to learn to play this. If when I go to visit schools for the book, I'll play it and sing it. Somehow, some of the folks up at the publisher got the word around that I was a musician. I didn't know you were a musician. I didn't know you were like a guitar player or, so you're a ukulele expert. I'm like, no. And then all of a sudden it became real. So I actually had to learn it. And so the last few months I've been playing it. Now I can play a couple of other songs and I'm kind of into it a little bit, you know. I've learned that I don't have a particularly good singing voice. But I love the Van Dyke quote about the birds, and it's kind of the my mantra for this tour was, use the talents you possess, for the woods would be very silent if the only birds that sang were the ones that sang the best. I've actually shared that quote with kids and kind of discussed what it means. And I think it's a wonderful thing, especially for anybody trying to do anything creative or whatever. Put it out there. Trying to be the best is a terribly hard thing to do. I think you really just want to do the best you can do.
Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Exactly. Very good. That's good. Yeah. Because that could be the enemy of the good. And not only that, it could lead to kind of a unhappy life, you know? So.
I think that's why so many writers drink.
Right. Exactly. Yes. And the problem is, with the social network today, Stephen, with that thrown in, before you have your first cup of coffee in the morning, you could see what everybody else is doing and what everybody else is saying about what everybody else is doing. That could be really good or it could be really bad, you know?
I heard a very good quote about looking at social media and how to assess what's going on. And they say, don't judge your life by someone's onstage life.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. Absolutely.
That's what they're choosing to present to the world. It's not the complete story.
Right, right. To be honest with you, it's a little bit of a struggle with me because the world, especially the world of publicity and creating a book, you did your best to make something that you want as many people to know about. You want them to know it exists, you know? But it is sort of that for me in my personal career, it's an intersection between me doing something I love, me making a living doing it, which is already just a success. I mean, I'm not saying my success. I'm just saying the fact that I'm doing something I genuinely love, that I loved when I was 5 years old and 10 and 15 years old, and now I've been able to do it and actually send kids to college and pay a mortgage and have a family. It's a gift. You know, it really is. And the way I was raised, the way my dad and mom taught me to be, it's a complete contrast to what I'm sort of, in a way, nudged to do on social network. Hey, look at me. Look at my new book. Look how great it is. That's just hard, you know, if I'm being really honest. It's a little unnatural for me.
Well, now you can throw it all away and just become a professional ukulele player.
I am aware, for the Memphis listeners, recently, I have become aware of the Memphis Ukulele Band, or...
I'm not familiar with them.
Yeah, look them up. And I'm getting the name wrong, but I have threatened to my wife that I will learn a third song by Christmas.
Now, what's the other song besides? There's a whole
Then, you know, all right, so I'm really exposing myself. But yeah, Three Little Birds by
Bob Marley,
which is, you know, kind of the easiest song to learn and one of the go-to beginning ukulele songs. And I'm not going to sing that because that one requires
a... Copyright.
Yeah, well, yeah, there you go. That's better. I was going to say voice.
With this feeling you have toward the social media and the self-promotion and such, do you think you could do a children's book about social media?
It's an interesting thought. I have thought about threads of ideas about just sort of politeness, nobility. You know, those are things that I've tried to put in Otis, and how do we treat others? That's not new. I mean, it's an age-old thing, basically, the golden rule. It's not about this side or that side. I mean, of course, I'm no expert, but it's not about this side or that side or winning the argument. And it's not about this religion or that religion or no religion. It's about treating other people the way you'd want to be treated. Yeah, consideration for others. Sometimes we're trying to win so much that we completely discard other people. Whether you're trying to get a parking spot or, you know, or a table at a restaurant, that's really not the way we want to live, you know.
I always forget who said it. I think maybe it's Henry James. It was, I think, an 19th century American author said there are three rules for being human. The first is to be kind.
Yeah.
The second is to be kind. And the third is to be kind.
Bingo. Yeah. Yep. It's great. I love movies. So this documentary that's out about Mr. Rogers, in this moment of our political world in the year 2018, it's great that we put up on a pedestal through a major movie documentary, the life and works of Mr. Rogers. I love the fact that he did what he did and said what he said and lived what how he lived despite everything else.
Well, and so much of our contemporary American society, the only value we're encouraged to see is monetary value.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And that's a hard one.
So what do you got working on right now?
I illustrated a book called If I Was the Sunshine, written by a wonderful writer, just a beautiful poetic picture book writer by the name of Julie Fogliano, who has, in my mind, a really wonderful backlist of just beautifully written and beautifully illustrated books. Julie Fogliano, If I Was the Sunshine, and it comes out next spring of 2000. I'm writing a few things of my own, and I have a couple of things kind of brewing. One is a Christmas project. Probably shouldn't talk much about that. And then I've just recently accepted a project by a Michigan writer, Lisa Wheeler, another just amazing picture book author that I have the privilege to illustrate. And it's called Someone Has to Build the Dream. I don't even know if it's announced yet.
Hope you didn't break any contracts there.
Yeah, no, I don't think I did, other than to just say it's a really meaningful thing. It's a real blessing for me to be able to not only do this kind of work that I believe is for an important audience, but to be able to, you know, knock on wood, still have, you know, always have a few books in the works, you know, for a guy who's making pictures out of his house and being able to make a living and, you know, contribute to my family and all that stuff. That goes hand in hand with Lisa Wheeler's story about the nobility in the trades, the nobility in work. That's probably all I should say. But but yeah, that's a couple of years out, you know, Stephen. So hopefully I met you a few years ago and here we are a few years later and I'm working away. It's a good thing.
I'm working too.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome.
Well, Lauren, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. It's been a pleasure every time I've talked to you.
Yeah, thank you. And I really appreciate you having me on and I appreciate our friendship.
Lauren Long is the author and illustrator of There's a Hole in the Log on the Bottom of the Lake, which is published by Philomel. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.